Tots, he has one, other three divided among seven children with potatoes. She, his wife, has an egg later. The real tragedy is that for some people nowadays, food has become the addiction of choice, and we have obesity as a massive problem. And for others, there's real genuine hunger and starvation, with arguably probably less nutrients in the diet than they had even in Edwardian times, when they were surviving on a couple of mouthfuls of meat. So this commission makes its report at a really apt time. And what we need for those who read it is not just a digestion of its recommendations, but action. So on that point, I think I'll hand over to you.
Thanks very much indeed. And look, thank you all very much for coming tonight. On behalf of all the commissioners, also I'd really like to thank the Fabian Society for convening this meeting. Experts and the Fabian Society staff have done a huge job of work supporting us and providing the secretariat, not to mention there's a third foundation providing the money. But more so, all the people that we've talked to in the last 12 months, we've been in London, Sheffield, Lincolnshire, Grimsby, Glasgow, we've had lots of submissions, we've had a lot of material submitted to us. We've produced the interim report, which you haven't seen, you should read in connection with this, it's got a lot of the detail in the background. And it's because of them, and because of all that material, that we've come out with the report that we have today. So what have we found? I think we should group them into two big areas. The one is the immediate issues for people on low incomes in the UK today, particularly finding an increasing number of people facing a crisis in access to food. Parents skipping meals in order to feed their children. People squeezing the food budget because it's the only bit of the limited budget they can squeeze because they have to pay the rent and the mortgage or the rates or the gas or the electric because it's the most flexible bit. And also having to trade down what they consume. So as going for calories rather than nutrients. And we all know that there's a real problem over the price of a nutrient balanced diet compared to the cost of cheap calories. That's at the personal level. There's a set of key tensions, though, that we've also found that are relevant to solving the problems around food and poverty, which, when they're solved, could impact on the poorest most, unless they're solved very carefully. One of those, obviously, is around health. There is a health gradient. The poorest in our society tend to have shorter lifespans and longer periods of morbidity, a lot linked to diet-related diseases, which has obvious personal costs, but also health costs, likely to rise. And so there's a health issue around the kind of diets we've got. The other one is sustainability of the food system that we've got. We have strong evidence from the UK Food Champion that whilst we've been lucky for the last 30 to 40 years with a system that's fed us, it isn't fit for the future. There are whole questions about the sustainability of that. And the third area, of course, is that for many people working in Britain and the rest of the world feeding, helping feed us, they get poor wages and have poor working conditions. And if we solve those three problems, it's likely that the food price is likely to go up in the long term. So solving those problems can only be done in a way that doesn't undermine the poorest already, because you will see the conditions worsen rather than getting. So why then do we think the government's not, this is the tip of an iceberg as we've talked about it, and food banks. It's because of those kind of problems, it's because at a personal level we know that the people who go to food banks are not the whole range of people who suffer from what we call household food insecurity, which is much broader and the number of people much greater. But the big problem is we don't know how many there are. No one measures this in the UK, and that is one of the challenges we face. And there are food banks are generally a means of last resort, and often there's a stigma attached with people that want to go. And the members of our expert panel of people living in poverty dealing with food issues, none of them have been. They know people who have, but they actually haven't gone to these. You know, they take down debt, they squeeze what they're doing. They're very like the mother there, except in this case, the mothers don't eat. They said they're going to tell the children they will eat later, and they actually are not eating. So that's why, when we look at as a whole, we don't think the government's got this right to resell. They've kind of outsourced thinking and work and responsibility for eating well to charities and businesses and individuals. And the food banks are really a sign something really fundamental going wrong. And that's why we have to look more broadly at the root causes and to have something that brings a connected, coordinated approach that links things to do with health and environment and wages and so on together. And businesses have been given more responsibility under the public health roles with a responsibility deal, but their actions are too piecemeal, they're not sufficient. We need something much stronger than that. And finally, we get a lot of moral exhortation to be people to eat better, or what, as if they don't know, as many of our poorer people say, of course we'd like to do that, but we can't afford it. And also, people live in an environment in which the pressures, especially through advertising and marketing to children, have to consume the kind of diets that are problematic. So, those are the whole range of areas where we have identified a set of problems. I do urge you to actually read the whole report and read the conclusions at the back, folks, because in the executive summary, the printed version, conclusion 5 is missing. I'll tell you about that in a minute. It's about the poverty premium. Do you know what the poverty premium is? The poor pay more for most of the things that we take for granted, whether it's food or electricity or gas or white goods. The costs are much higher. And one of the recommendations we have is you need the coordinated report across government to bring the people together, not just in government, but in Ofgem and the other regulatory agencies and with businesses to say we actually have got to reverse this so it isn't the poorest who are paying most. So that's one of the recommendations that we get in there. So they're not recommendations, actually, they're really points for action, because there are a lot of actions that can be taken. Some of them are quite immediate and can be done quite quickly, and that's one that we think should be taken quite soon, and you can take action on that. Some are more long-term, addressing the issues around income, because the core issue is if people had enough income, we wouldn't be talking about quite a lot of these things. And that requires some long-term look at the minimum income standard, at how the real living wage is developed over time, and we've got quite concrete suggestions for how we should do that. We've also looked at the government's plans on farming, and there's a 25-year plan which you may or may not know about it, but it's very narrow. It doesn't take into account these bigger issues on sustainability, on welfare of the people within the system, wages and so on. And we've suggested that should be expanded. In a similar way, we think when you look at the application of universal credit, the fourth of whose key objectives is eliminating poverty, ending household food insecurity should be included in that objective and one of the key measures of any success of these kinds of policy. So we have a whole range of policy suggestions in there. Advertising is another area we think there should be, and that's an immediate issue. Convening a review of the current regulations around advertising, particularly to children, that's changed dramatically in the last few years since those were drawn up. We had evidence from former advertising executives about how small children are being targeted through advert games and all kinds of other things. I think this was mentioned last week in the Public Health England report. That requires people with the power to convene and to act on it, and that requires action by government. Governments at national level, at regional and devolved level, and at local level. And we think, too, there's a lot of potential for action at the local level, at the city council level, the metropolitan borough council level. And one of the good things is, there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's not actually being connected enough. The best practice is not being spread enough. I got an invitation, actually, just a few days ago to a meeting next week in Birmingham on food insecurity in Birmingham, a city-level response. We know in Manchester, in Glasgow, in Leeds, in various places. And we've suggested that we should at least have 10 pilot actions in the poorest areas in this country to focus at the local level on what can be done through local non-profits. So our hope with you here tonight, when you think about what's going on, is how can you lend force to getting these actions in place? Have you got connections with the local food access plans? How do you put pressure on the different governments? One of the great things, possibly in Britain now, is that there's a range of possibilities in the devolved administration, in the different policies, to do things differently, try things, and never just spread the best practice. So that's the kind of big overview picture I wanted to paint for you. I'd like to hand over to Jeanette now, and then Liam, and then we'll throw it over to the floor, as Yvonne said. Thank you.
Well, I just interrupt Jeanette before we do that. I completely forgot, because I'm completely social media literate, but the hashtag is food and poverty, all one word, if anybody is tweeting. Any thanks? Sorry. Over to you. That was a commercial break.
I'm not used to this. And when I was asked to be a commissioner, I actually ran somebody up who's very close to me and said, should I do this because I'm not an academic? and suggest it would be good practice. not quite sure what he meant. But I've really enjoyed it, and I want to talk about this from a school meal point of view, a school cook point of view. I have met over the last 14 months some fantastic people. And when I started and co-founded Food for Life, I didn't realise that food poverty existed until I started going into what is now over 2,000 schools. And then I realised that there was something seriously, seriously wrong with our system. So I'm very proud and I'm very humbled to have been asked to take part to do this. There are 2 million children being fed by one charity for breakfast that go to school hungry. It's 2015. We are one of the richest nations on earth. That can't be right. There are over 1 million people using food banks, and they're the people that we know about. How many of those people who are still hungry but are still too proud to go to those food banks? How many of those are we missing? I hope that this report will go on, and I hope you guys will deliver on that. I hope that all of the news, it's been in the news, it's in the newspapers, I hope that, as they say up north, it's not tomorrow's fish and chip paper. I hope it continues and we can actually eradicate food hunger and food and poverty. We shouldn't be living in a nation like this. And when I see children, when I go into schools and I see children who have got rickets, and funny enough, I actually was looking at some of these talks that I've done over the years, and a few years ago, and it was probably about 5 years ago, I did a talk up in Newcastle, and I said that rickets were back, and I was actually booed, because they couldn't use it. It isn't. Well, actually, it was, and it is. And yesterday we heard about TB. So we have to do something about it. So thank you very much for coming here tonight. As Jeff said, I hope you do read the report. It's well worth a read. Tweet, do as much as you can. But let's make poverty a thing of the past, not of the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeanette. I don't know if any of you heard the radio this morning. There was a young woman leaving care, aged 18, and she's got less than £55 a week to live on, which, again, as Jeanette says, in a country of our wealth, is absolutely scandalous. Which is a very good cue for Neil Cooper, who's done an awful lot on debt and food poverty. Neil.
Thank you. I just want to say three things in my 3 minutes. Firstly, I want to pay tribute to the real experts who've contributed to this report. We had a panel of experts who have really been fundamental in shaping our thinking. Dave, Sarah, Kasia, Letitia and Samara. None of them sadly can be here tonight. They all live with food poverty every day. We can talk about it tonight. They'll wake up tomorrow morning, half term, struggling with how they can feed their children. It's a daily reality for them. And without their insights into what that means, this report wouldn't have been half what it is. Secondly, I want to say that food poverty, or having the security of being able to adequately feed yourself, your family, should not be a party political issue. It's a fundamental need. And in fact, according to the UN Charter that we've signed up to as a country, it's a human right. I also think it's a litmus of a good society that we can eradicate the need for people to go not just hungry, but struggle with food insecurity, of not knowing where their next meal is going to come from. Lastly is the good news, that we are still the sixth wealthiest country on the planet, and no one does need to go hungry. What we lay out in this report is 15 very practical recommendations. I've counted at least 12 of them don't involve spending vast amounts of public money. It's about government taking a lead, coordinating, pushing, nudging, doing the things that government could and should do. So the message from this is seize the day. The government can tackle food insecurity if there is political will to do that. We've seen a little bit of movement today from Ian Duncan Smith. Whatever we think about that, that's a step towards recognising that food poverty is an issue that government has some responsibility for, and it's up to us to push forward and realise the goal that no one should go hungry in this country.
Thank you. So we've got a rallying cry. I hope somebody, I know I'm supposed to be neutral, but I hope somebody asks some questions about reining in the food lobby and the food industry, because we have 500 children a week going into hospital for work on dental decay, which has to have some connection to minus spoonfuls of sugar in every can of Coke. But I would like to open the floor to you, and if you could say who you are and whether or not you'd like to direct your question to a specific person, please. So this gentleman here, and it would be nice if some women put their hands up, please. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair of the Land Culture Council, Electricity Council. If I do direct my question to Diana, would there be any correlation between the anti-trade union legislation and the rise of food poverty in the UK?
Thank you.
Dan Crosby from Food Ethics Council, and any of the commissioners, picking up on Neil's point, what can be done to avoid this becoming a party political issue and being thrown around?
I'm
Kevin
Harvey, the Shadow Environment Food and Rural Affairs Secretary. I'm always tempted to dance that, because it is difficult, though. Frank Field's group that he set up, that did the Feeding Britain report, is very much cross-party. I think the danger party, though, is that in some ways by neutralising it, by saying we all care as much about this, you then lose the sort of political impetus, the anger to actually do something about it, because it just becomes lots of people sort of saying, yes, it's terrible, and food banks are doing a wonderful job, and so on. But my question really is, I think you're right about the power of the food lobby. We were getting emails today of a group that's been set up to lobby against the sugar tax, which is meant to be grassroots, but I suspect isn't quite in support of them. But the political world, on the one hand, you've got a government that doesn't like intervention, but also doesn't particularly want to acknowledge the scale of the problem, because some of the blame for it has been placed at their door. And it really is how you get around that sort of criticism of the nanny state and actually make the case for government having a role to play in improving people's lives and improving the food that is sold and access to the food, having the money to buy that food, and everything from teaching children about nutrition to actually having a food plan. But in Bristol we're doing some brilliant work in terms of making food available to local communities, but there's still whole swathes of the city that it doesn't reach. And I do think government intervention and local action is the key, but it's quite difficult to push them. You know, what is the tipping point that actually makes them decide they're going to act?
Okay, so we've got anti-trade union legislation and its relationship to food poverty. We've got how do we keep this as a cross-party issue, and we've finally got how do we create a tipping point so that government does start intervening and there's more community action. So if we start with Diana, and then come down this way and then go back again to the end, please.
Yes, thanks. Obviously, one of the things that I think is really important about this report is that it does consider the position of the workforce within the food and agriculture industry, as well as all the other issues around it. So the short answer is why it would make a difference, or why it makes a difference, is because where there are trade unions, there is better pay and there are better conditions for people. So if trade unions are weakened, then the impact can be that it will be the same kind of rates of pay as in workplaces where there aren't trade unions. But I would also say it's obviously much more than that. I mean, one example that we've given in the report is about the abolition of the Agricultural Wages Board. And my own union represents workers in that sector. And the year after it was abolished, we were able to show that 44% of people that worked in that sector had not had a pay rise. And I think we, in some of the other questions as well, just looking at, we obviously there are some solutions that if you don't have to worry about the workforce are really easy to call for, but we wanted to make sure that it's not those snap judgments that actually could increase the food poverty of the very people that are working in the industry. Because there are contradictions of people that are working in supermarkets and working for big food manufacturers who are, need to claim tax credits, who don't receive the living wage. And obviously there is pressure downwards on their wages along the supply chain, which is something that we've tried to bring to the forefront in this as well.
I think anger is appropriate. I'm angry that people are going hungry. But I don't want to get into a blame game, because I think that even though we might want to blame certain people or certain parties, but that just pushes them away. What I've been really encouraged about over the past few months is Feeding Britain, and is the fact that increasing numbers of Conservative MPs are seeing the impact of what's going on in their constituencies and actually speaking out on these issues. And if we can achieve some degree of cross-party consensus, then that will help persuade the government that this is something that they can work on. Lastly, I think the countervailing power to the food lobby is the food justice movement. There's a huge power and potential in local communities. People are passionate about these issues. People volunteer for food banks. People run community food projects. If their energies can be turned even a fraction to actually lobbying and advocating as well as handing out food, then it would be a very powerful movement, because it's across the country, it's in every constituency, every MP would then need to take the issue seriously, and I think that would transform the attitudes to this issue.
I think there must be some lessons from the Living Wage campaign, because that's done terrifically well and that's apolitical, but over to you, Jeff.
Yeah, and also I would say, one of the things we thought about was, what are the basic principles that underlie the action that we want to be taking? And we've listed five in here. And I suppose one of the first steps would be to say, can you all agree that everyone in the UK should have secure access to nutritious, sustainable food they can afford, and nobody should live in a state of household food insecurity? All political parties, yes or no? Food banks and other forms of charitable food provision should become unnecessary. You might argue about the date, but what is the vision you want? Decent work is the best way of achieving sustainable food security for most households. But the social security system also has an important role to play for many, both in and out of work. The links between low income and diet-related ill health should be broken. People on low income should be protected from price rises and other potential negative consequences arising from the essential action needed to address the long-term environmental, health and workforce challenges in the food system. If we can say we all agree with those principles, then it is likely that different political parties might have different ways of saying this is how we're going to try and tackle it. But I would like to see an agreement that we agree on the principles. We actually, as a country, are signatories to the Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights, which includes the right to food, which it is a duty of the government to respect, protect and fulfil. How are you determined to do that? Again, there may be just different views about. But I think, in one sense, it is to ask our politicians to make very explicit where they stand on this and the approaches they wish to take to solve the problems. And if they say we actually don't want to solve the problem, then that is a bigger issue. And that makes it clear where people stand. So I think there's something about making things explicit so that people can then focus around that. We do talk somewhat about the power of the food industry, and we are particularly concerned about the way in which government has stepped back from its role, if you like, as protector of the weak against the strong, by leaving a lot of stuff to voluntary regulation. And it has been said to us by some large firms, you know, why don't you legislate? Because we'd like to do it, but if we do it and our competitors undercut us, we're not
in a level playing field, and we're not going to harm our business in that way. So there are business interests in seeing change in this. So I think one of the things is creating coalitions of different people who actually can support this principle. But there is a challenge, because some of the businesses and some of the products that are heavily marketed and advertised are the very things we actually don't want people to eat. So it's also about transitioning from one kind of business activity to another.
Jeanette, you achieved a tipping point in school meals. How do we get a tipping point in government's intervention?
I think we have to keep lobbying, but we also have to get the people behind this. This is not just, you know, communities behind this, and I think that's really important.
To carry on from what Jeff was saying on the need for vision, and I think there is a real need for a laying out of the fact that poverty and inequality and illness and food insecurity and environmental sustainability are all connected, and that those connections need to make be made clear and explicit as a way of framing how we want to move forward. And I think it's a combination of things. Everyone signing up to a vision, and that need be a part of political activity. And as Jeff was saying, then people will have different approaches to addressing it. But I think I would also say that one way of making the case for the need for regulation is that all the evidence shows that an absence of regulation leads to an absence of results. And that's true when we're talking about health promotion, it's true when we're talking about regulation of environmental problems, and it's true when it comes to poverty and inequality. And I think we need to make that really, really clear. That won't guarantee action, but it will at least show that there's no excuse for the inaction.
John.
If I could specifically address the avoidance of the dominant party politically, perhaps not. Is the perception of children a party political issue? The 1,000 on critical days policy, for instance, is supported by four major parties, it would seem to me that in the context of the consequences of food poverty on families, particularly the issue of children's protection and children's development, not just their protection, present government is committed to improving standards in schools, where we know children are arriving at school and are properly fed, and they're not capable of committing themselves to study during the day. The issues of young people going into work. People are not in a healthy state to work, and I think we have to look at what the state of policies of our government are, and try and get them to commit to healthy food and to affordable food in all of this. The Prime Minister, shortly after he was elected, said that preventing ill health was the only way that the NHS was going to survive, and instantly his colleague in number 11 cut the public health budgets by $2 million. Where there are policy contradictions, I think we have to pick those up and address them. The other thing, which I don't think should be part of political, and it is in the report, and I think it's very important that we have emphasised this idea of food as a right, and I think there are other aspects about food as culture that we need to get back on the agenda and celebrate. Because we've lost seasonal foods, we don't have periods of the year when there's cheap foods, if you're using big supermarkets, that is. So, the things like seasonality, like sitting down at the table, not being bombarded with marketing from age one when you're watching TV. But all of these things I think we need to be willing to speak up for, because food and culture and the times of the day and the times of the season are extremely important to us.
Can I just ask a follow-up question? Because we do have a government that believes in the free market, which means very little intervention. So, but we also have a bill of, what, 17 billion a year because of diabetes and obesity. So is that not an area, Jeff, where the contradictions actually need to be untangled?
Well, exactly. Something like just over a third of all the chronic disease deaths are due to food-related problems. Poor people get poor food, and they also get bombarded with the most marketing and the most demand, the most profit from our industry comes from targeting them. So we are creating generation after generation of people who think it's normal to lose all their teeth at 20, to have a heart attack at 45, or to live with diabetes for 30 years of their lives. So these are things which none of our governments in my lifetime have ever responded to. So I do think we have to press the moral and the economic case for healthier people.
I just pick up on the words free market, actually. 10 years ago, I used to do a lot of work with negotiators in the World Trade Organization, and I remember the founder of that saying, this is not a free trade organization. This is a rules-based trading organization. All markets have rules. And the question is, what rules, in whose interest, and how do they operate? And that's the issue that we have to look at, and that's in a sense what John was talking about. So I kind of slightly quoted the idea, yes, people have got a very big emphasis on markets at the moment, but it's the nature of the markets, whether markets are appropriate, and whether the rules that the actors in the markets operate are delivering the results you want. And I think we could say they're not delivering those results at the moment. So you need to look at that. I'm very sorry, and I send apologies, I should mention it earlier, that Andrew Coy cannot be with us tonight because he's on his way to Brussels to do something with the EU. But he used to work for the Food and Drink Federation as an important part of our commission, an important part of raising some of the issues that we talked about here, out from an industry perspective, and a sense of needing to address these issues for sustainability, because the businesses won't survive unless they change and unless they address some of these issues. And I think the other thing that I might say is that we do call for a robust measure of household food insecurity, by which we mean the inability to acquire or consume an adequate quality or sufficient quantity of food in socially acceptable ways, or the uncertainty that one will be able to do so. There are various methodologies for this. There's an example from the FAO in the report that happens in other countries. But if you haven't a clue of the scale of a problem, it's quite difficult to say we've actually solved it. And we think that there is action that could be taken by both the academic community and the National Statistical Office and research councils to actually get this sorted out. And that's one of the areas we think is a very specific thing that could be done in a relatively short time if the right people came together. And that would actually help identify and clarify what's happening with the use of those.
Okay, good. More questions, please? This gentleman. And another one, please. One more. Terrific. Okay, thank you.
Tom Whiting, food writer. In the course of my lifetime, I have watched the level at which campaigning had to take place or could take place, going higher and higher and higher at the political level. Until now, we have reached the point where those who control the food industry are in many instances much larger in magnitude and in power and in scope than the countries in which they operate. I know that Jeff is very aware of this through his long work with intellectual property rights and those problems. And now we face the imminent passage of Atlantic and Pacific trade agreements, which are going to put, if it happens, will put in place legal structures selected by the food industry or by industries themselves to decide whether the laws that are passed by individual countries are allowed to stand. We can see our successful campaigning can result in structures that can be wiped out by those who will not benefit from their being in place.
Thank you. Going to find from a Labour and London Assembly member. A few years ago, we actually voted for, I led an investigation for the London Assembly, and going back to cross-party point, one of the reasons we got some of the recommendations picked up that might not otherwise been picked up by the Mayor was because we got cross-party agreement on the whole report. I mean, to be honest, I wasn't sure that all the Conservatives had read all the recommendations, but it didn't make a difference in terms of getting the Mayor to pick up things on child hunger and sort of increased funding for breakfast clubs and the goal of zero hunger. And I was really pleased to see that you've actually set a definite time point for a goal for eliminating the need for food banks. Because I think there's a real danger that we spend too much time sort of focusing on better distribution networks and not enough time on identifying ways to prevent it. So I was really pleased to see that you had a very definite and actually quite ambitious goal. How do we avoid a situation in which we make food banks a permanent feature? I mean, that's my basic question. How do we avoid, and we put so much effort into that we lose sight of the fact that actually, essentially, I think pretty much everybody in this room, including those people who volunteer at food banks or run food banks,
would
like to see them go.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, my name is Councillor Mike Roberts. I have been a member of the LGA Labour Group and served some of the subcommittees. My point at the moment is that many of us in our government are facing the perfect storm of the spending review, which most people will find out the detail of, you know, few weeks' time or less. The reaction to the battle for tax credits and the cuts in short start schemes. I know my own major local authority, not my local authority, Hampshire, is about to cut 60% of its short start budget. And a lot of other social support side is about to go as well over the next 18 months. This, of course, has consequential effects on those families which need that support. I know the £1 million odd children's centre, which I was managed to build up in my own ward, which is the private ward, one of four in the Hampshire and Surrey area, will basically go completely. Now, that already supports families for their health with work, supports, breakfast clubs, etc. All that will go. And as a trustee of Home Start in my own local area as well, I can see that perfect storm developing where those families which are on the edge will increasingly have cause and effect even more. The thousands of people which are already on food banks will explode in the next year as well. And I just can't see an end to what that perfect storm is going to be. And I think that's the reality that many of us in local government will be faced with, as starkly as that, in the months ahead. What do we do and how do we do it? It's not a question of politics. Because even in Jeremy Hunt's constituency, which is next door to my ward, he has food banks as well. So even in Bosch Farm, there are food banks, but the other half don't live well. So what do we do in such circumstances?
Right, we start with John. So we've got, how do we rein in the power of global immigration? We've got, how do we stop food banks becoming a permanent part of the welfare state infrastructure? And all the families that are just coping, when they get clobbered by tax credits and benefits, how do we help them, stop them from going over the edge? So, John, you start.
Well, I'll start with the last one first, I think. I mean, all we,
I mean, this is another one of those complete policy contradictions, isn't it? They want children to have a better start in life, but you're going to demolish all the chill starts. That is a contradiction. I don't know what else one can do other than to campaign at national, local, whatever levels. And in that context, I mean, Sir Michael Marmot in his inequalities reports, the evidence-based for early years intervention was, the major thing from equalising incomes, and we get away from those early years reports. How do we deal with the sort of almost, if you like, the exit strategy for food banks? I mean, we heard a lot of evidence, particularly in Scotland, about food banks morphing into other aspects of local food policy and local schemes, growing schemes, box schemes, actually trying to get away from the sort of charitable and more towards the sort of local economic development type function, and also in Boston, I think more towards the rights and advocacy end of things. So, and quite a degree from all food banks in all parts of the country about a sort of ambivalence about what the volunteers actually have to do. That, in many ways, for many people, they would rather not be there, but they feel a need and they know that they're doing the best and most conscientious job they can at the time. So I think all that effort, all that knowledge, all that willingness and expertise does need to be celebrated and acknowledged. But I think we would all say we hope it doesn't, we don't see it as just handing out tins in a very sort of demeaning way for not that much longer. The question of multinationals and competition, like our questioner there, I am deeply and greatly suspicious of the TTIP arrangements. From a health service point of view, this has been criticised for some time about the impact on the National Health Service, but in terms of what they will do to consumer rights in food quality and food safety, in terms of what they will do in terms of environmental standards, and in health and safety at work, and in workers' rights, minimum wages and so on, we already have enough evidence around the world for what the investor-state dispute system can do, and the UK Faculty of Public Health has come out with a very full statement in total opposition really to the TTIP. But we didn't really discuss that in the Commission.
I agree with all the comments you made. I think just like to say one more thing about the food banks discussion, which is, I think, dangerous and needs to be dispelled, is this idea that food banks somehow solve environmental problems because they avoid food waste, and that's a good thing, and so on and so forth. The food waste is a problem which is to do with all sorts of other factors, including the food industry's power. And that this should not be seen as a solution. I think that needs to be really clearly articulated.
It's a massive question that I don't think we can answer at the moment, of how do you remove the food banks? There isn't an answer. When we're talking about food waste, Tyrone was just saying about food waste, and we've become these perfect cooks or chefs where everything has to be immaculate. We go and we buy an apple that is perfectly red, perfectly formed, and because that's not the case. Life isn't like that. So why do we demand, those of us that can afford to go shopping, why do we demand perfectly formed veg, perfectly formed carrots, perfectly formed fruit? You know, the meat has to be XYZ, and there are so many people that can't. And that's how I afforded to use local food 15 years ago. Because I said to the farmer, I don't want a perfectly straight carrot because it's going into a rumbler. And for those of you that don't know, a rumbler is a big piece of equipment that skins and peels potatoes and carrots. Please don't put onions in, it's one person did. But anyway, so I got those local carrots cheap. And when they are cut up, the children don't know whether they were straight, bent, or what they were. So, you know, we've got to look at what food we are actually saying no to. So that's food waste. And Hugh Fernley, actually, is doing something about this. On families who are just coping, again, there is no one answer. There really isn't. It has to be political, but it also has to need to be community. And I keep going back to that word. When I was growing up, I lived in a community. We have just, funny enough, just had some people move in next door. They've been there now for 6 weeks. She actually spoke to me yesterday. She's been there 6 weeks. And we're losing that community and that sense of looking after one another. And I hope that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I just say, though, I lived in South London and we have a big bin in Tesco's called the food bank, and every single day it's full. And I think that's actually a tribute to the fact that people make their own minds up. They don't listen to this very divisive discussion with Strivers, Strivers and Sherpas. And people do have compassion, and I think they have great sympathy for the arguments that are being made by people on this commission. So, Jeff?
I mean, following on, yes, there's a huge, nobody thinks anyone should go hungry, I don't think. But all these massive volunteers, you know, local food bank, it takes 70 people to keep the thing open for 2.5 hours a week. And you've got this replicated around the country. The global international deals we did not discuss, obviously, within the focus of this. I think what we should look at is what is the effect of such deals, changing the rules, upon people, on people in poverty, upon the ability to deal with the challenges we face on sustainability, the challenges we face to have healthier food systems, and the challenges we face to have decent paying conditions for people working throughout that. If these rules diminish those, they're the wrong rules. But we haven't examined the TTIP, but that would be the principle I would talk about. On the question, I think Tara was very informed here. Food surplus or waste is not a solution to the fact that some people are having to go hungry. It's a temporary stopgap measure, and which most of the people involved recognise. There's a new campaign started yesterday, I think it was launched, called Stop the Rot, which is about getting the supermarkets to actually have a properly audited amount of waste they produce right through back through the system and so forth, you know, rejecting all the carrots that Jeanette was talking about. So I think there are things that have to be done to deal with the waste, which is an environmental issue, it's very wasteful, greenhouse gas emissions, etc. And it's not a solution. And one of the things about the target, and thank you for mentioning that target on the end of food banks, is, and it was said to us by some people in food banks, you must say we're looking for an end to it. It's a very different way of thinking if we think we're trying to get this out of the way by 2020. We know it's necessary now, we don't want anyone to rely on it forever, and we don't want to be doing this forever. And that's quite a different way of thinking than if you think, well, this is going to be the future of the world or the future of the UK. Now, if you start to have that way of thinking, then I think there's a better way of saying, and mobilising all those range of people, say, well, what are we actually going to do to get rid of this in our particular area? There is quite a lot of different work going on. The Sustainable Food Cities Network is also thinking about these in different cities. There's this, as I say, event on next Wednesday in Birmingham, which is a very interesting response. They're looking at how they can be innovative in Groningen with the resources they've got around these whole issues around food and security. So I think there are things going on that we need to start connecting together. We are very clear in our report that it makes no sense to cut the current public health funding schemes and budgets. This is a bonkers bit of economics. It's cutting something in one place, which is going to cause enormous economic costs in another place, the health budget. We've got figures in here. I think it's 6.7 billion. Cameron, our stalwart, wonderful secretary, who's done a vast amount of work, will pick me up if I'm not remembering the figures right. Like, that's 6.7 billion currently around it costs the health service for obesity. But it's vastly more, it costs people in the economy and so forth. So if you're doing things that undermine cutting pennies in one place to cost pounds in another, no, this isn't sensible economics. And so it's about rethinking some of those policies and making sure you don't cut things now. We're quite clear about that. That's recommendation 9 if you want to have a look at it. We do talk about the need for trialing the sugary drinks duty, because that also tackles some of the issues. But there's a question of what you'd do with the money if you did such a thing, so that's a question that's an open question to put in there. I think, too, the other thing we have on the immediate, for those people, which is not everybody. I noticed it was said, I think someone mentioned this announcement today, which I say, I've been travelling doing interviews and things, and I gather putting an advisor about getting a job in a food bank. Well, actually, the evidence we've had is many of the people who go to food banks have jobs. What they don't have is jobs that don't allow them to feed themselves well enough when they pay the other fixed costs they've got. So it's not as if every one of them got a job who's going there. So there's an issue around that. But I think it's very clear, and that we know that in response to the APPG report, the Frank Field report, that the DWP has been looking at how they can improve the system. Well, it should be improved quickly everywhere so that you remove a whole swathe of people who are going. This social security system that's developed, this safety net, goes back a long way. It goes back to the early part of the last century, but came in a big way at the end of the Second World War, when it's one of the great victories that came out of the Second World War to establish a system of a safety net, which anyone could need. And one of the things we talk about is the need to make sure this is a real safety net again. There are some costs in that, we recognise that will take some time, but the things you could actually do immediately, and we need those improvements to the system so that you don't have long delays and people don't lose their, as one of our expert group lost his house because he had a 3-month delay in a decision and was made homeless for weeks. You've got to get those things done immediately. They're things that can be done now, and so there are some of those. And how you stop food banks becoming embedded is you actually say we don't want them. Then if we don't want them, what are the policy changes that we have to make? And then you start to think. But if you think, well, that's okay, we're just going to let them be there forever, then you're not going to get the policy changes you want. And that's, I think, one of the key issues. That is a political choice.
Thank you. So much of this is about just people having decent incomes, which is, very basic, really. Neil?
I think the issue about getting rid of food banks or the need for food banks, it's about, as Jeff said, it's about ambition. And having that as a political ambition. In Scotland, the Scottish Government actually, I think, does have that as an ambition. They've just set up a working group, including people in food poverty, to come up with a plan for how they can do it in Scotland. I think that would be challenging without action at a UK level, but that's what they want to do. I think the challenge at a UK level with government here is nobody is actually championing the issue. DWP, they will say their remit is not to tackle food poverty. And I think that's part of the reason why Duncan Smith has squirmed on the issue for so long, because he doesn't want to be pinned that this is his responsibility. The Department for Health recently answered a parliamentary question saying it had no responsibility for tackling food poverty. So what we need is somebody that's got the ambition within government to make the change that needs to happen across different departments. DWP's got a key responsibility. Frank Field says quite clearly, if DWP sorted out the errors, delays and sanctions that would reduce the numbers needing to go to food banks by half. And it wouldn't be about spending huge amounts of extra money, it's just making the system work for people so that they keep money rather than end up destitute. So there are practical things, but it's who in government is actually going to drive that forward. That's why our first recommendation is that there needs to be a coordinated cross-departmental approach and a minister that's going to drive that agenda forward. They might come up with a different plan from ours. That doesn't matter. There's somebody there who it's their desk and their responsibility to come up with a plan.
Presumably they'd have to have cabinet status, wouldn't they? Otherwise it would all just go into the back room of some sort of service.
We're recommending it's in the cabinet office. It needs high level backup.
Diana?
Yes, I wanted to go back to the point about levels of decision making, because I think increasingly we've seen in the trade union movement with the financialisation of food companies, so that it's being the concern really that decisions are not being made about food but are being made on other grounds. So I think that the point that you've made is a really, really important one about at what level can you influence what. On the other hand, I think what we've tried to do in the report is to have proposals which deal with the fact that we need to be able to make change and put forward recommendations that will make a difference at every level. So I, whilst saying we have to look at that and at saying certainly the International Union of Food Workers, which brings together representatives of workers across the world, has done the most concerted research on trade agreements and exactly who owns food and drink companies nowadays. They have made a number of points about this, which have influenced certainly how I have seen this. But I think that the concerns that we've got is that there's a danger of people saying, well, that's too far away, there's nothing we can do about it. So we also need to look at the issues at other levels that we can make a difference on. But I think in terms of the trade agreements that you were mentioning, why that's relevant, although we haven't discussed it directly in the Commission, is because obviously if we make a decision which then can be challenged by a company, if we, in the sense of this government or this country, makes a decision that can then be challenged by a company, obviously it's something that we would be very deeply concerned about. So that's the concern there. But I did want to mention the one of the proposals around action that can be taken at other levels, because I was very struck by some of the discussion around access to nutritious food in different communities. And I think that's something that hasn't necessarily doesn't get enough airing. And we've made a particular recommendation towards local authorities in addressing this. But I take the point at this point in time when money's being taken away and you've got non-statutory requirements, it is extremely difficult for local authorities to be there in put into this position. But I think the fact is, there's a really good section on this in the report and in the interim report. If you have to add in the cost of travel because you don't have ready access to nutritious food, then that makes food much more expensive. Or even then, the choice when you do travel a little bit is nothing like for people in other areas. All of those things, I think, are really important to consider in this debate as well. On the setting a goal, I think it's very important. I had some concerns about our first wording on this because it sounded like we were anti-food banks, and in the sense of what they're doing now, which obviously is really important and good work. And I think the wording now is very clear. It's not saying we don't agree with what people are having to do now being very important and valuable, but it shouldn't have to exist in this day and age. And how we make that transition is something I think that we've led to in the report. But I wanted to say that because I think you can talk about this debate in a way that seems to be criticising food banks now, which are clearly doing an important role at the moment. But I've been really appalled at some of the removal of target dates for ending poverty by this government. And I think that it's really important that we have in place target dates to say we don't need food banks because there is not that need. And that is vital. So I think that's probably sufficient.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, go on. Could I just come in? So I'm, sorry, introduce myself, secretary to the commission, and I'm here to sort of give a little bit of detail, but the commission has been so well briefed that I haven't had to. Jeff's right, government estimates for costs of treatment of obesity and overweight, £6.7 billion this year, projected to rise to just under £10 billion in 2050. I just wanted to sort of add on a point that's not been made yet. It's in one of the recommendations to sort of give a point of detail. Look, we know these issues, many of them are long-term, commissioners have spoken about that. But one of the recommendations that we've put down for action right away is sorting out some of the problems in the social security system, delays, errors and sanctions, that will reduce quite rapidly, if they're able to do that, the acute need that's driving people to food banks in the first place. So I just wanted to add that in.
Yeah. Can I just pick up a couple of points? Yeah. On the minister or whatever, this is not an innovative idea. They've had, you know, cabinet-level people who minister for the Olympics, sport, and we're talking about feeding people. We've got a minister for the Northern Powerhouse. I live in the North, I'm not saying this is about taking responsibility, and it's been said, because these are not simple issues. They are interconnected, and it does require a lot of work. We do give an example in the report of what's happening in West Cheshire at the initiative of a food bank. And there's a reference to it, and you can read what they've been doing, working with the local authority and working with others. So there are things going on. And the other thing that's perhaps not come out yet is, you know, food, this really runs through all our lives. It's social, it's cultural. You probably take it for granted. You have a children's birthday party, your kids come around. Friend wants to have a friend come round for tea. That's a real problem for people. There's a social and cultural aspect of food. Jeanette referred to it in some ways. And we've been greatly helped by having Sarah Woods, who's sitting at the front here, as a narrative artist in this, who's worked with a lot of the groups, because we have to understand this stuff, not simply at an intellectual level, but at the personal, emotional level, that, you know, the role food plays in people's lives and the importance it has in being social, in being part of a society, an inclusive society. That's why the definition we use talks about, and I'll quote it exactly at the beginning, there he goes, socially acceptable ways. We don't want a ghetto, do we, where just one small group of the population has to have a special way of being fed because they're poor, and can't have children's parties because they're poor, when the rest of us have all that choice. It kind of undermines the whole idea, doesn't it? So I think those are important points that perhaps are sometimes lost when we talk about all this kind of more technical detail, how you're going to get X and Y to do what. I don't want to dive in back.
Can I ask what a narrative artist is?
I'm a playwright, but what I've been doing with the commission is really working with people whose lived experiences in poverty, going to food banks, and just trying to take the research out to those places and bring back some of those stories and experiences.
And they're littered through the report. And what they're not anecdotes, they're people's lived experience that give evidence, that make real and give flesh to the massive amount of evidence we've had from academics like, I think I see her behind Dan, from Liz Dowler and others. So they put the two things together, that's what they did.
I inject a bit of optimism here because I'm feeling a bit depressed. In America, we've got the $15 an hour campaign with fast food workers, and that's had tremendous success. So I think there is a tipping point when the public get it and they suddenly start exercising pressure. McDonald's actually serves real salad now. Kraft has changed its food. So I think we shouldn't underestimate that if you do get the right message, you can actually instigate real change very, very quickly. So we've got time, I think, for three more questions, please. Okay. Yeah, we'll take two more. A basket full of riches. So we'll have your question first, please.
Thank you. It comes back to Jeff's point that we were just talking about just now. Sorry, I'm Rebecca O'Connell. I'm a researcher at the Thomas Corwin Research Unit at the New Zealand Institute of Education. As a researcher, definitions, concepts and measures are very important to me, and they're very political too. How important is it, do you think, that we come to an agreed definition in the UK of what food, household food security is?
There are two people at the back over there.
My name is Josh Sutton. I'm a freelance writer. In the 18th and 19th centuries, food riots were both common and widespread in this country. They were whole communities coming together and mobilising in an effort to tackle food poverty. Do the panel think that we might see food riots in this country in the near future?
Tonight. Anyway, there was another person there. Yes, that lady there.
I've been working in schools for the Universal Infant Free School Meals as a support person for those schools where, like, I'm sure everyone's aware of what we're talking about when I say that, but it's the Initiative for Free Meals in State Schools for Children up to 7 years old. Anyway, the government's targets for 87% uptake, and there's a whole swathe of schools that don't meet that by a long way, and I've been going out trying to support those schools and do something about the uptake. And this, I mean, here you're trying to give people food, and I'm afraid most of the schools I've gone to have been in very poor deprived areas, and these are poor children, and they're opting not to have a free meal, a good meal put in front of them and eating it. And the attitude to why this is very, very poor across everything, from the parents to the children, the dining room assistants, and the head teachers. And I think it's all very well talking about food banks, and as you said yourself, that really is just the top of the iceberg, the food banks. It's the people who don't go to the icebergs. It's those children who don't, for whatever reason, take out free good meals put in front of them that is the real issue of food poverty, I would say. And how do you reach that?
Okay. And there is one more over there. Yes.
I'm Rachel Creighton, a dietitian and current master student of public health and nutrition. And I think it's very unfortunate that within government structure there's no longer a Department of Nutrition whose responsibility it would be for the welfare and sustainability. But aside from that, I wonder how we could support the people attending food banks to become advocates themselves and lobby for food poverty.
I'm Nick Lee, and myself, I'm a member of the House of Lords, although once I can be very proud of that. I'm a former general practitioner, and I've been chair a number of years of the All Party Parliamentary Food and Health Forum. We've had a lot of academics and people from industry talking to us. What I'm really interested in is improving the quality of processed food, which is what most poor people eat a lot of. And this is one of the main reasons why we see the social scale in obesity and chronic disease. There is a choice between regulating the food manufacturers or, as they wish, getting them to agree voluntarily to adopt certain standards. I have, over quite a long number of years looking at public health measures, I'm fairly disappointed about voluntary agreements being effective. And so I think that more regulation in the food industry is absolutely necessary. But it's resisted by not all members of the food industry. There are some who say, well, if you've got food regulations, then we can have competition within those regulations, and I can't actually name the food manufacturers who are in favour of this, but there are a few. And I wondered if the failure in future work could look at how regulation, which is effective, can be brought in subtly so that the food industry actually accepts it.
Thanks. And there's one more person over there. Can someone have their hands up over there?
Hi, Natandron, a Labour councillor in London.
Just a quick point and a question. I think completely agree that you need cabinet level buy-in here. But I would say that Liz Truss right now, she's sitting at the cabinet table, she has responsibility for food. It's a reflection of how weak DEFRA has become in their brief that we're saying we need cabinet level here, and I think it's very sad that it's come to that. Just so I think that the report's fantastic. There's a really interesting bit, not covered so much tonight yet, and really interested to hear the panel say about this. The stuff about, there's a great quote in there from Tim Benton about how the agri-food business at the moment is just not fit for purpose. Over the next 20 to 30 years, the impact on climate, impact on the environment, impact on health, the way food is produced. You have a recommendation about expanding the 25-year for food and farming. Could you say a bit more about what kind of thing you imagine would need to happen to kind of meet the scale of the challenge?
Okay, so because we're running out of time, the commissioners could just choose one of these. We've got, can we have an agreed definition on food insecurity? Are we likely to see food riots? Should we encourage people who use food banks to become advocates for themselves and the need for better food? How do you challenge, well, this is a class issue as well, in deprived areas, how do you encourage people to have children to eat decent food? How do we get effective regulation, particularly of processed food? And lastly, agri-food, the way the food is produced, how can we make real change? So can we start from this end this time, please, Diana?
Yeah, I wanted to pick the one on regulation and the food industry. I think the points that's made in the report and also was referred to in the introduction is the fact that this doesn't have to be, there is no need to be at loggerheads with every single food manufacturer. And actually there are ways of moving forward together, but the way that everything is organised at the moment is there are incentives built in to not make moves where you can be undercut by somebody else who does. And as long as you don't have regulation to manage that process, then all the time there can be undercutting of the worst kind. I think looking at that supply chain and having ways of regulating the supply chain, not just in this country but internationally, is obviously going to be critical to that, and you need those agreements to be cross-cutting. And I think we shouldn't be frightened of that, but I think there's a danger of people saying that that's too much intervention. But that's, if you don't have that, certainly as a trade union, we find there are times where the people that we're most having to have disagreements with, they say, well, our hands are tied by this system. And as well as people undercutting, there's also the demands of the retailers and others that they're supplying for that they have to meet, and that can massively affect what's going on as well. So I want to make that plea that regulation has a really important part to play, and actually you don't have to fall out with all the food manufacturers in the process.
I want to answer three of the questions together, actually. The reason we won't have food riots, the reason people don't take up free school meals, is stigma. There's a huge stigma associated with poverty, that people feel that they're themselves to blame. That's the issue that we need to challenge. The shame is people in poverty are never in the room, and that's why I'm really sad that the expert panel aren't here. They are the best advocates for tackling these issues. We've done work not just in Salford but in Halifax with people in food poverty. They get it. They get that this is an issue of justice. They're angry about it. There's a fantastic, I can't tell the whole story, but a guy in Halifax, when we said the UK government signed up to the UN Convention on the Right to Food, he said, you mean people in this country have a right to food? He was really energised by that. So we really need, if we're talking about campaigning, to engage, not see people at Food Bank as clients and objects for our pity. These are people who have stories to tell, are passions, and they can be the real advocates for making change happen.
Will there be riots?
I don't think there will be riots, because at the moment people feel very down. I think there's more likely to be incidents of depression and suicide, which we see, than riots. What we need is a collective will, but that has to be built.
Okay.
younger girl in, unfortunately.
I bring up the 87% uptake. Where's the lady that okay, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to have a willingness to do it. And that willingness comes from the community, the school community. So you've got to have a head teacher on board, I was looking. You've got to have the staff on board, and you've got to take the children with you. You're not saying to the children, this is what you're going to eat. You are explaining why. Parents as well, so cooking, gardening, farming, farm visits, all those sorts of things. I was absolutely, I couldn't believe it, that a year six teacher didn't realise that a cow had to have a calf to keep producing milk. And I thought, you know, I know I haven't got any qualifications, but she was and so that's, you know, so it's quite dangerous. So you've got to have that, that whole school community working together. And once, you know, the cook is really important. And again, as I say, I was looking, I've got a really good head teacher, and he said, Jeanette, you know, the three most important people in the school, and he gave them in this order as well, which I was really pleased about when you hear the answer. The first one was the cook, the second one was the caretaker, and the third one was the head. and that is really, really important. So, but he's also getting parents in so that they're not afraid of food. Yeah? Yeah? Because a lot of what we've got two generations who don't know how to cook.
Yeah.
And sorry, can I just very quickly say, you know, when I started Food for Life, I was a co-founder. Today we are doing 1.5 million meals every day to at least a bronze standard. Every school that we work in, our children know where their food comes from. And I think that's really important.
I want to pick up on the sort of environmental question and also say that that was it is an important part of the report and it shouldn't be forgotten, because poverty is also about poverty of, for future generations as well, and the decisions we make today about our food system will influence the ability of future generations to access a secure and healthy and sustainable diet. So climate change and the whole kind of food rights thing, one thing is that climate change is going to undermine yields, it's going to increase volatility of supply, and it will also reduce the nutrient content of foods. There's lots of good evidence that it reduces both the protein and some of the micronutrient content in foods, and I think that's worth bearing in mind. We're talking about, I think there was a question about the food plan, and I think what we really need is a plan that links production to consumption. The purpose of agriculture is to produce nutritious food that feeds us, and that needs to be made very clear. But I also want to say that Jeff has rightly emphasised that food security is about culturally appropriate diets. There is a broader challenge for all of us as we move forward into an era where climate change is increasingly starting to hit home, that what we consider to be a normal diet will have to be questioned. We need to move towards diets that reduce our environmental footprint. And that means perhaps eating less meat, not perhaps, actually definitely, I would say that very strongly, and kind of refashioning our concept of what a sustainable diet looks like. And that also involves bringing in all the cultural communities that are in this country, not just your standard British meat and two veggie type thing. And so I think we need to have a big conversation about how we're going to move forward on that. We need to a plan for food that is that links production to consumption, that delivers nutrition, that is resilient in the face of climatic and other environmental shocks, and that does its bit to actually address the problem. And once we have that vision of what a sustainable food system, a sustainable pattern of consumption looks like, I think government should require the food industry to provide their vision and their plan for how they're going to play their part in achieving that. Whether it's regulation, my favourite regulation, or whether it's voluntary measures with fairly long teeth, I think we need to have that. So that's basically what I'm saying.
Thank you. John.
Could I just add to that? I think that's also the answer to the question on the food and farming strategy, because as a commission, we were extremely struck by the precariousness of our food supply for all the reasons Tara has described. We shouldn't assume it's a commodity and it will be there tomorrow. And we have to get away from what we have at the moment, which is a food and farming strategy, which is how we sell more food in export. We need something like the Canberran feed itself again, a reprise perhaps. And it does need to accommodate all these issues of food security. And I think that also ties to the food riots then. I mean, I don't think we'll have food riots yet, but we do have food theft and we do have food crime. And, the abuse of our food system is growing and likely to become more so. And at some point, some tipping point in the failure of crops around the world, there could just be an escalation of prices that does tip enough people into a food poverty situation where a riot might happen. On the responsibility deal, Laura is absolutely right. And there is now formal documented publication of the failures of the responsibility deal studies by the London School of Hygiene, particularly on that goal, but also around food. This has just been obfuscation and delay and avoidance of any genuine responsibility. So you have to have regulation and you have to have taxation. And I think for the reasons that Jeff described, giving them all a level playing field by actually putting that in place would be
the thing to do. So, I think that leaves me the question about the definition of household food insecurity. You know the one that we've used. I think beyond the definition, it's actually finding out what the state of play is in this country. Yeah. And I would very much hope that following this meeting, those people able to, from the research community, supported by research councils and, if necessary, the National Statistical Office, come together and say, this is, if you're happy with our definition, use that. There are various methodologies for doing it. Choose the one that seems appropriate in Britain and get on and find out. So we have some measures to look at that. But again, drawing in those other comments, doing this in a framework that the future is going to be different from the past for all the kind of reasons we've heard. Environment and so on, thinking about what's a culturally appropriate diet, what's a healthy, sustainable diet in the 21st century for a country that will represent a very, very small part of the world's population in 2050, in a continent that will have less economic and political power than it's used to having. The world is changing. We need to have a vision of where we want to go, some ability to tack around to get to it. And recognise, I think, that food is at the heart of any healthy, successful society. The conviviality around it, the ability for everyone to share it, and to make it sustainable. There's lots of evidence from history of civilizations that have got it wrong with how they manage the land and so on. We don't want to be another one. I thank you all very much for coming, for the interest that's been taken in the report. It's a report. It's not an end, it's a start. And it's a start that's got a lot of other tentacles that connect to it, there's a lot of material that link to it, and I hope this is a process of people gathering on after this and picking up the action and going with it. Thank you very much.